2025 marks the 60th anniversary of the first Honda Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix. More than half a century later, the drive and innovation that powers Honda racing still inspires everything Honda does, from F1 victories to the Civic Hybrid being named the 2025 North American Car of the Year. Honda Racing is leading the charge when it comes to innovation. And here's where it gets really cool. Every Honda-powered F1 car is packed with sensors, hundreds of them, all feeding live data straight back to the Honda Racing team in Sakura, Japan. We're talking about real-time analysis that helps engineers squeeze out every ounce of performance on the track. And the amazing part? That same cutting-edge thinking is making its way into the cars we drive every day, thanks to the expertise of Honda Racing engineers. Their work has led to advances like the hybrid technology now used in Honda's consumer vehicles. The 2025 Civic Sedan Hybrid is engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Civic and the latest Honda innovations at Honda.com.
Member Week is here at Lowe's. Don't miss your chance to get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, faucets, vanities, doors, and more. Shop our exclusive deals happening in-store and online now through July 18th. Not a member? Join MyLowe's Pro Rewards for free today and get ready to save more. Lowe's, we help you save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Hi, this is Mario Andretti, and you are listening to Beyond the Grid.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Beyond the Grid, presented by the new Bose noise-cancelling headphones 700. I'm Tom Clarkson, and I've got to tell you, I'm super excited about this week's guest. It's no exaggeration to say he's one of my racing heroes, and I know I won't be alone in saying that. In a lengthy career, this man won 109 major races, including 12 Formula One Grand Prix, the Indy 500, the Daytona 500, several IndyCar titles, and yes, the big one as well, the Formula One World Championship in 1978. I'm talking, of course, about American racing icon Mario Andretti. Mario's story would make a sensational Hollywood script. He was born in what was war-ravaged Italy in 1940, but spent a proportion of his childhood in a refugee camp after the area in which his family lived became part of Yugoslavia after World War II and was under hardline communist control. Seeking a better life, the Andrettis then emigrated to America, to the land of opportunity. But not before Mario had got the racing bug, thanks to a trip to Monza, when he got to see his hero, Alberto Ascari, in the 1954 Italian Grand Prix. The rest, as they say, is history. Mario worked his way up the ranks to become not only one of the most versatile racing drivers the world has ever seen, but a household name synonymous with speed. Quite simply, he won in everything he ever raced, and he remains as passionate about Formula One and motor racing today as ever he was. Earlier this year, I was privileged enough to sit down with the great man in Indianapolis, where he won the world-famous 500 back in 1969. It was wonderful to discuss one of the most incredible careers our sport has ever seen, and it was a conversation I just couldn't cut short. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Mario, welcome to Beyond the Grid. It's a huge pleasure to have you on the show. Your story is a true American fairy tale. You went from humble beginnings to become arguably the greatest all-round race driver in the world. It's an incredible story.
Well, yes. I mean, I've been so fortunate, so extremely fortunate, and definitely driven by a burning desire, you know, to pursue that probably... you could consider many times the impossible dreams. As you can see that everything that happened to me would not have happened if Italy did not lose the war. When Italy lost the war, they lost the territory where I was born. And again, as a negative as that may be, you know, by us refusing to be, you know, obviously under hardline communism in Yugoslavia and wound up in a refugee camp and then ultimately coming to America. If we didn't come to America, this would have still been the impossible dream, I think, for the rest of my life. So one thing I learned very clearly in my life is that, and I've seen so many negatives become positives, and this is one of them. I kept reminding my dad about that. Anytime that he complained about, you know, leaving his home, leaving everything, I said, Dad, look what that has done for all of us, you know. So anyway, you know, it's all good.
Mario, just take us back to the beginning. You say, you know, you were trying to see the positives with your dad. What was the mood in the Andretti camp when you boarded that boat to America?
Well, my dad, when the visas, he waited 3 years for visas after he applied, and he had almost forgotten about it. And so it was decision time. And he said, well, we're going to America. I said, we'll probably be there for 5 years and then come back. And so he softened the blow type of thing. But because it was definitely an unknown, yes, we had relatives here on my mother's side and all that, but it was definitely an unknown. So here again, you know, we go to a different country, a different life, different language, different everything. But again, you know, we were kids. So, you know, as kids, you're up to anything. You know, it's actually, it's adventurous, you know. So, and we were all in. And actually, Aldo and I had 3 years of English in school. And in Italy, we chose English as the language. And we thought we were fluent, which obviously couldn't even actually, when we landed in Halifax, Nova Scotia, which was the first landing before we went to New York on a ship, we had like 8 hours that we could roam about. And we didn't even know how to ask for a postcard, you know. So my dad thought that we were fluent in English, you know. But I think some of the basic grammar helped us a great deal once we actually went to school here. And then and we learned the language quite quickly. We arrived in June. I think we vowed by Christmas, I said, I want to understand everything that has been asked from me and so on and so forth. And it was quite true, actually.
Well, how tough was it for you and Brother Aldo going into a school, not being able to speak the language, no friends?
Well, we were the curious kids, you know, the twins, the foreign twins and all that in this small town of Nazareth. But we were treated well. There was no issues whatsoever. But there was a lot of curiosity, obviously. And some of the girls were curious as well. So that was cute.
And what kind of a kid were you, Mario? Were you very busy? Were you intellectual? Were you academic? Were you sporty? Were you scientific?
Well, I don't know if any of that applies, but I think that one thing we learned immediately once we arrived here in June, was in June, so the racing season was in full swing, and we arrived on a Thursday. By Sunday night, the local races were happening at the fairgrounds in Nazareth. And we were by my uncle's house, and we could see bright lights in the background and could not understand. It was kind of neat. And all of a sudden, a huge roar of engines, because the races were at night. And Aldo and I looked at each other, and we booked. I mean, we followed the noise, and we see these brute-looking modified stock cars on a half-mile dirt track. And the race we had seen previously was actually the Mille Miglia, from the Futa Pass at the Abetone, and the year before we saw the Italian Grand Prix. You know, some of our friends over there took us to see that. So the Mille Miglia and the Italian Grand Prix were just in the clouds, were so impossible, the impossible dream, but that's what ignited everything. And but when we saw this local racing, we thought it was doable. 2 years later, we started building a car to race there, exactly. And, of course, we armed ourselves with some local geeks, you know, that understood what's going on, because, again, we were just purely driven by desire, didn't have the knowledge and all that. But and we started, you know, working on a car, which was ready 2 years later. And you had to be 21 in those days to be raced professionally because of insurance, whatever it was. And we were 19, and so I think this is a story that's been around. And so we had to fudge the birth date on our license, and no computers in those days, you know, so it was not easy, you know, it was, you couldn't, no one could check. And we became, you know, and we said, well, we're ready to race. And we didn't look 21. So, you know, the question was, you know, to us, you know, why should we let you race? Well, we raced in Italy, you know, the Formula Junior. Count Lorani had a Formula Junior. You know, we raced in Ancona. All bull, you know. And but they bought it. And actually, in those days, you know, the racing drivers, they didn't drive, they didn't have driving suits or anything. And Aldo and I, we sent for two Sala Sport driving suits, zippers and all. And we showed up with those, and it was a little bit
You looked the part.
We looked the part.
Now, you say you worked on cars. Who taught you about cars? I mean, is your dad or?
No, no.
Trial and error.
Trial and error, believe me. It was just something out of necessity, you know. I was never a mechanic or anything, but, you know, you had to learn for your own sake, for your own good, and to protect your own interest type of thing. And you just do things, and then you do, and you make mistakes, and then you learn, and you do some more. That's really what it was. There was no other way.
And it sounds the same approach to your driving as well, in terms of you'd done nothing. Yeah, I know you claimed the Formula Junior thing, but you'd actually done no racing prior to that dirt track racing. How quick were you? How did you get to grips with all of that?
Well, you know, we did quite a bit of street racing, you know, and actually we did quite well, you know, and just...
What do you mean by street race? Is that sort of after hours?
Yeah, off hours and just going crazy on the roads and all that sort of thing. We had a hot car, a 57 Chevy, which was really, you know, the cat's meow in those days. And my dad bought that, you know, bought that for us in 2 years after we arrived here. And so, but then, like I said, when you're just driven by the desire, you know, somehow you succeed in some ways. There was one car, two drivers, you know, and my twin brother Aldo, you know, we want to do everything the same thing, you know, together. And so there was a toss, you know, he won the toss. I was kind of happy. We won the very first race. He did, and so did I the following week. And then we did the crashing, we did the winning, with all the things that, you know, go with it. But it was a very auspicious beginning. And we were in, this is 1959, as kids, we put together $500 between all of us. You know, there were four other buddies. And then we borrowed from the bank $500, which was signed by a gentleman by the name of Ivo Taviani, who owned a block plant where we used a lot of his tools and all his welding and all the things. And we paid all of our debts by July.
What, in prize money?
In prize money, yes.
Can you remember the moment you got your first paycheck from racing?
It was cash.
Cash is king.
Aldo, the first, he won the heat race, which is qualifying heat. Usually they have three qualifying heats. They call the consolation, then the feature. So he won the heat. He started last, and it was $25. They go to the window to pay off right away. And the race was $125. So the first race we did $150. And then we used to put all this money in the drawer. And at one point, we even had $350 that we were counting and still going well. And so, like I said, we were putting it away. Of course, you know, we had expenses, fuel, tires, and all that sort of thing, which was fine. But we were flush.
What did Mum and Dad make of you racing? Were they supportive? Was Mum in particular supportive?
That's another story. Because actually, my father was vehemently against it, and there's no way that we could even ask if we could do it. So the only protection we had was the language barrier. And in fact, we raced the entire season without him knowing. And we were winning some races, and even the boss at work, you know, would go to, "Hey, Gigi, man, your kids are really doing well." He didn't understand what the man was saying because, you know, my dad didn't learn the language very quickly at all. And my mother did pretty quick, but he didn't. And so, again, he didn't get it. He didn't know that we were actually racing. And unfortunately, he found out at the very last race of the season, which was in Hatfield, Pennsylvania. It was a invitational. You had to qualify for that race. You had to be in the top three in points on the circuits within a 150-mile radius. And that's where we used to race three circuits. And Aldo and I qualified. Even though we were alternating, 1 week he would drive, I would drive the following week. But I won races in Nazareth, Mahoney Valley, and Flemington. And so anyway, we qualified. So for that last race, I was driving a modified for somebody. Actually, I got a ride from somebody from Allentown. And Aldo was driving our sportsman car, which was more under power. But he was fighting in a heat race. Qualifying heat race. He was fighting with the track champion, Freddie Adams, and he was qualified. You know, all he had to do is hold what he had. And he tried to pass him, and he hooked the guardrail, you know, and he went end over end. And they gave him his last rights that night. He was critical. You know, he had a basal right here, the base of his
skull
was cracked and so on and so forth. Anyway, so he was in a coma for about a month or more.
And you couldn't hide that from Dad?
The next day, I mean, the doctor said, if parents here, or we call the police. And because I called my mother that night, and I said, Mom, my mom actually knew what she was caught in the middle, but we never talked about it. So I said, Mom, I said, actually, I was racing, and Aldo was watching me. He was standing in the back of the pickup truck, and he fell. He fell off because he bumped his head and he's in the hospital, but we'll be home in the morning. And she was very quiet.
Mom didn't believe that.
Mine didn't believe it. Moms always have that intuition, you know. And so anyway, the following day, you know, he said, so my dad felt vindicated, you know, because he said, I told you, you know, they bring you back in a body bag. They bring back more body bags than trophies, you know. In those days, what did he know? I mean, he didn't know that Alberto Scari was killed. I mean, just as we were coming over, and he was our idol, you know, and there were so many fatalities, you know, and then Bill Vukovic, you know, which actually, he was publicized in Italy because he was the first one to top 120 miles an hour average, which is translated to over 200 kilometers per hour. And so when we saw the headlines, Bill Vukovic wins Indianapolis at 210 kilometers per hour average, I figured, oh, my God, you know, that number, you know. And
magic number.
Yes, magic number in 1954. And so my dad, and then the man is killed, and then, you know, that. So, again, we know the fatalities aspect of it was too numerous, and that's all he knew.
How did Aldo's accident affect you?
Well,
did you ever question whether you wanted to race anymore?
No. In fact, you know, when you're driven, you know. And in fact, you know, we used to, I would ask the doctor, you know, I said, what should I talk to him about? What should I say to him? You talk to him about anything that would excite him. So I kept saying, I said, immediately it's the last race. The car is total. And I kept saying, Aldo, don't worry. We're building a new car, which I was. We're already building a new car for next year. That's all we were talking about. And we were. You know, we never stopped. And, you know, it's a good question. And sometimes I could never dwell on that negative, because if you dwell on that negative, you know, you just don't belong there. If you're going to do it, you have to be ready to face the risk. There's no other way. And that's it, you know. And I lost along the way, not just there, you know, my brother, you know, obviously he survived and all that, and he raced for another 10 years before he had another one, which ended his career. But I lost some of my closest friends, you know, in a sport over the decades of the 60s, 70s, and some in the 80s. And, you know, we were not clear of that until, I think, after the new century, you know, a lot of the safety aspects, you know, really, really came to play. dramatically, but these were formative years of trying to, you know, deal with the safety more vigorously. And quite honestly, I always say that that was not the case, if we would not have done that, I don't think the sport would have survived, you know, as it became more and more commercial. You know, companies that invest millions of dollars to be part of a race team don't want to go to funerals. You know, they want to celebrate. So, and I think the GPDA movement and so on and so forth, you know, we were not asking for more financial side. We were asking for safety. And, you know, we're talking about Niki Lauda, you know, whom we just lost, you know, an icon in that area. And he was as responsible as anyone to just get to the point, you know. And
did the risk give you a thrill, though? Did you get off on the thrill somehow?
You know, if there was no risk, I don't think there would be that much of an attraction, quite honestly, because you're trying to defy something that can actually hurt you or even kill you. And it's like a wild animal trainer, you know, and that animal will either purr and just, or just kill you. And you just want to get your arms around that. And there's no bigger satisfaction than have the car respond to your command. And that's really the challenge that every driver faces. And that's what really keeps you going. That keeps you motivated, obviously. But it's always something that you know not everybody can do. Or at least whether it's true or not, you feel that nobody can do. Not everybody can do.
2025 marks the 60th anniversary of the first Honda Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix. More than half a century later, the drive and innovation that powers Honda racing still inspires everything Honda does, from F1 victories to the Civic Hybrid being named the 2025 North American Car of the Year. Honda Racing is leading the charge when it comes to innovation. And here's where it gets really cool. Every Honda-powered F1 car is packed with sensors, hundreds of them, all feeding live data straight back to the Honda Racing team in Sakura, Japan. We're talking about real-time analysis that helps engineers squeeze out every ounce of performance on the track. And the amazing part? That same cutting-edge thinking is making its way into the cars we drive every day, thanks to the expertise of Honda Racing engineers. Their work has led to advances like the hybrid technology now used in Honda's consumer vehicles. The 2025 Civic Sedan Hybrid is engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Civic and the latest Honda innovations at Honda.com.
Say big to Menards and keep cool in the summer heat with a new window air conditioner from Denali Air. Quickly and efficiently cool your spaces with auto and eco modes to maximize performance and save on energy costs. Featuring 3 fan cooling speeds and a remote control, allowing you to cool your space from anywhere in the room. Save big money on Denali Air. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards.
Now, you've said a couple of times, you've talked about how driven you were. What drove you? Was it the lure of success? Was it trophies? Was it money? Was it sort of almost running away from communism and everything that was going on in Europe or in certainly Eastern Europe? What was the motivation?
The absolute motivation was just to drive and to be able to emulate some of your idols. You know, what really captures your imagination? Someone that's like God, and that is the one that actually really got me just totally absorbed, was Alberto Ascari, just the way he was depicted by the press and so forth, being so cool, so calculated and all that. And I just loved his demeanor, very relaxed, but like a tiger, you know, just like we were talking about, just like Fernando Alonso type of thing. And so as a kid, that's what impresses you, you know, what a cool guy, you know. If I could just be like him, type of thing. And it was all of that, you know. And then when it's something that you can't have technically, like it looks like the impossible dream, it drives you even harder. drives you hard. Why not? Did I ever have a plan B? No.
Well, and how close did you get to getting a proper job?
I dabbled at it, you know, because I married very young. You know, I was 21, and I had responsibilities, of course. And quite honestly, I did some training as welding, you know, because I needed to do that for our, you know, to build our cars and so forth. But at the same time, I wasn't looking for a steady. I never really had a total steady job. Actually, it was all on the take, you know, either, you know, in the race itself, racing. When I finally reached 21, which was legal to just go, I wanted to go into single seaters, and I left the stock car to my brother. We went through three cars, by the way, just to get, not to get ahead of myself, because I had to take a sabbatical for the following year, and I was winning some races with the new car that we built. And one of the events that, you know, usually during intermission, by mid-season, intermission, there was all an intermission between the heats and the feature itself. So we befriended the promoter, Jerry Fried, and I said, Aldo would like to do a few laps, you know, with our car, you know, just to get his feet, you know, warm in there. And so he let him do that, and he wrecked it end over end. He hooked the guardrail on the outer. I think, oh my God, you know, it was in the papers, I think, wheels flying. And a week later, I never missed a beat, and we built another car in a week's time, and I won the first race after that car, and actually ran out of brakes in between. I was going to pull in a state, and then and still won. So things were going well. But as soon as I reached the legal age, I wanted to go into, you know, single-seaters, midgets. And I had my wife's dad and his partner in the business, I had him invest in a very famous, what they call Deuce, and it was number two car, that actually we were able to buy. And then, so anyway, and that was a three-quarter midget to race indoors during the winter in the hockey rinks. But it was very popular because some of the top midget drivers were racing there. You know, Len Duncan, Tony Bonilla, you know, some of the icons and that. And, you know, those are the guys that were driving full-size midgets. And I needed that. I needed that, you know, to measure up, you know, against these individuals. And I got to tell you a story. I don't know if I'm rambling on, but
it's fantastic.
You got to hear this story because the deal that I made with my father-in-law, I said, you buy the car and I will give you 50% of everything, every single dollar that we earn from day one, and I'll operate the car with the other 50%. And then when you sell it, it's all yours. So it was a deal he couldn't refuse. And it was tough for me financially because, so I put Deanne to work. She was working at a blouse factory, you know, and she was pregnant with the first child. And I needed her money to freshen the engine. Every week we had to have fresh head, you know, it was an 850 Triumph engine in it. And we had to have fresh heads with the, you know, valve guides and everything. So if there was a puff of smoke on the indoor, you get black flag for the evening and you're out of the race. You know, you can't run the feature. And on the way to the city, you know, to Long Island, to Teaneck, New Jersey, we were going by this Bob's Motorcycle Shop. And it used to cost me $125, you know, to get fresh heads, you know, and then I would get to the track and I would have to put them on And so I was paying for that with what everything that Deanne was earning. So one of the races, you know, we're on the way over and she's sobbing a bit. She goes, you know, I said, Deanne, what's wrong? She said, nothing, nothing. I said, what's wrong? She said, I quit my job. I said, you did what? You got to be joking. I said, what am I going to do now with his head? You know, so I said, I'm 7 months pregnant. And I can't go on anymore, you know. So,
my goodness.
So we used to laugh about
yeah,
that. You know?
That's...
But so, you know, going back to, you know, okay, did you have a regular job?
No.
Barely. You know, but I used to depend on, you know, what we were on the track. Yeah. And so, you know, when you said already, what drives you? Well, I had to earn to be able to make it through, you know, as I was a responsible daddy early on in life. And there was all of it. You know, it's just you're not driving for the money, but that had to be part of it because, you know, you have to live. And the sport was, you know, very kind to us right from the outset, you know, quite honestly.
Well, it seems that 65 was the pivotal year for you. Tell me if I'm wrong, but you meet Colin Chapman, you have your first Indy, finish third. I mean, would you agree that that was the year where you sort of, it all started to ramp up quite quickly, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, that, you know, my objective was to reach a top level here in the United States, which was, you know, the IndyCars reach Indianapolis and all of that. And I think everything just was working, you know, very, very well. I mean, it couldn't have been any better from the standpoint of the opportunities that I had. I often look back and say, what if, you know, that wouldn't have happened. And actually, you know, my fortune was a misfortune, which was happening often, of another driver, which was hurt and worse. And then somebody had to take his place. And in fact, Roger Penske was supposed to be the one to test for that team, the Dean Benline team, and somehow he couldn't do it. So, and some of the crew chiefs actually, because I was fairly successful, you know, in sprint cars against the top guys, you know, Foyt and Branson, McCluskey, all those guys. And so they asked, why don't you give Andretti, you know, a try? And that was it. But anyway, this was 61, but 65, you know, but again, you know, it was very auspicious beginning, you know, the season, start of the season, you know, just up there. I had a second place finish just before coming to I led Phoenix. I was second in Trenton and coming to Indianapolis. Then, you know, we started fourth, finished third. And then at the end of, after that is a traditional banquet, you know, and of course, Jimmy won. And throughout the month, I tried to, very hard to befriend both Jimmy and Colin Chapman. And they were very, very nice. Just before we were saying our goodbyes, I said to Colin, someday I would like to do Formula One. He said, Mario, he says, whenever you think you're ready, you call me. I will have a car for you. Can you imagine that? Mm. Oh, I was on cloud nine. Mm. I said, man. And I said, okay, you know. So, and that's when I really, really, when Ford was actually, and you know, just hell for bent to do to win Le Mans, so they started this Le Mans program in 66. I said I'll be there every test. I will do everything you need, and I was you know, they were obviously trying to get, you know, every driver they could because they were very ambitious, you know, with all the testing, and we were doing some 24-hour tests and so forth. And I really befriended Bruce McLaren, and he was, you know, we became really good buddies. And I just watching, you know, his techniques, you know, especially, you know, he was very technical driver, you know, could really rotate the car in slow corners and all that. I had the high speed, you know, pretty well, you know, but I just needed to have just more of the technical side. And he and I used to just go out to dinner and talk about it. And
you and Bruce?
Yeah, Bruce and I, it was fantastic. Oh. And then in 67, you know, he and I won the 12-hour Sebring. It was a hard-fought race, just the two of us, you know. It was a tough day, and then things started rolling. By 68, you know, I said to Colin, I think I'm ready to test a Formula One car.
Why did it take you 3 years to ring Colin? You say, you know, he said, whenever you're ready, Mario, I'll have a car for you. Why did it take 3 years? Because a lot of people would argue you were ready sooner than that, much sooner.
I didn't have any road racing experience. But even when I was driving midgets, like in 63, there was one road race at Lime Rock, Connecticut. And actually, one of the top owners, it was so important, one of the top midget owners had John Cooper built a rear engine midget with an Offey engine just for that race to be driven by Mark Donohue, who was a road racer. And we were in the standard midget, and he had a two-speed gearbox. We only had in and out. And so you know, on a straightaway, you know, I had to ease out of the throttle, you know, throughout the race, but I was glued to his gearbox. And on the last lap, I passed him coming off of the last corner, and I just stayed on it, and it floated all the valves and blew the engine, but I won the race. So there was only one road race in the midgets, and I won that. And then in 65, there was only one road race in Indy cars, which was right here at the Indianapolis Raceway Park, and I won that. So I was hell for bent to try to do it, but I didn't think I was ready for Formula One for a while, you know. So when I felt that I could, you know, because I didn't want to just do it. I wanted to be fairly ready to just give it a go. And because the first test was, I said, I'd like to do Monza and Watkins Glen.
At the end of 68.
Yeah, at the end of 68, which he granted me. And we had a test at Monza 2 weeks before the race, and I was quicker than Chris Hayman had been in a Ferrari. And so that was, and I felt really right in the Formula One car at that point.
How did it feel?
It felt like I was born for it, honestly. I mean, I felt, because I had driven up to that point on the road course, and I had won. I had won, you know, just almost all the IndyCar road races. I won Saint-Gervais and Mont-Tremblant, kind of, you know, the both 100 milers. I had won, you know, Riverside. I had won, you know, several races before, you know. So, but it was the Indy cars are much heavier, you know, because of the way the rules are and so on. So, and it's a car that's obviously adaptable, has to be adapted to road racing and then ovals and all that. So it's not as nimble. And when I got in a Formula One car, it was, oh my goodness, you know, this thing is, because that's all it's for, road racing.
Yeah.
And somehow that Lotus felt so right, you know. And, you know, Monza is a relatively simple circuit to begin with. And so I felt good. And
they just stopped racing on the oval then, hadn't they?
Yeah, but the oval was only for sports cars.
Right.
I mean, they had stopped racing yesterday, full oval. But then I even ran 1,000 Ks with half on the road course, half on the oval. And in fact, but that was later, a year later. But, you know, the story of Monza is that I was up for the championship in 68 here. So I had the dirt track race right here in Indianapolis called the Hoosier 100. It was the biggest dirt track race. And so I had to come back here to race on Saturday. And there was a 24-hour rule, and I made a deal with Bacci Galuppi, who was the organizer in Monza, and Count Lorani, and, you know, that they would waive the 24-hour rule. And they said they did. They would, because we were in breach by about 2 hours. And Friday, you know, I only... in those days, every practice counted for qualifying at the time. And I only could run the morning and then take a flight to the U.S. and then race Saturday here and go back. And to protect myself, to qualify, because in those days, a lot of slipstreaming was done from teammates, you know, for qualifying. I got Bobby Unser a drive with the BRM, with Lewis Stanley.
But Mario... It's your first Grand Prix. Some people might argue that you might have focused on it and you'd have chosen a race where you weren't commuting from across to the other side of the world. I mean, it was an amazing schedule. And I suppose that's what Concorde was built for, was it? But did tiredness affect your performance on either side of the pond?
I'm a damn good traveler, quite honestly, because I can sleep anytime, you know, and... And, you know, there were a lot of this kind of me. I was, in many ways, I think I was criticized for some of that. You know, I don't think I gave up a damn thing, you know. I mean, of course, I would not prescribe that, you know, go across the ocean the same weekend and all that. But unfortunately, I was going for the championship here, so I could not, you know, really let go. And
that was probably worth a few quid, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah, that's the thing. Actually, This was the best paying of the dirt races, actually. And I finished second to Foyt, by the way, just for the record. You know, so I had a good day. And so And when we went back, in the morning, there was a protest. My car was on the grid. I was seventh on the grid. I was much, much quicker, you know, at the beginning in the morning, which is, you know, to be expected. But I was still seventh on the grid. And the car was on the grid and it almost made it look like we never made it. And there was a protest. And I still, and I think it was by Ferrari.
You still don't know for sure.
I still don't know for sure. But all I know, there was all Italians talking and calling, and they would not allow me there because I speak the language. I said, I'll submit to whatever you want. I said, if you want to do a physical or whatever, you know, I said, if that's the question, you know, if they're not physically fit, and they just would never even allow me there into the meeting, and they did not allow us to start. And so my actual debut was at the USGP at Watkins Glen, which I had never seen before, by the way.
Now, that's an incredible story in itself. But just one final question about Monza was, it was a baptism of fire into the political world of Formula One and who holds the power and the power of Ferrari. Yeah. How much of an eye-opener was that, the fact that you'd flown across the world and still not allowed to race?
Well, obviously, it was very disappointing, and it is what it is, but sometimes that's a reality of competition. Sometimes, you know, you just have to deal with it, and it's end of story. You move on. That's all there is to it. Nothing you can do. You know, so this too shall pass type of thing, you know. So, yeah, it's disappointing for sure. You know, we were all in for it, and just time that they did not allow us to start Le Mans. I was in the car just 5 minutes before the start. They pulled me out of the car because the chain that said that they changed the rear cooler, oil coolers, you know, from qualifying, you know, stuff like that. So I've been through some of that.
The crazy world of motor racing. But you mentioned Watkins Glen. So the debut eventually comes, as you say, 2 weeks later, at a track you'd never seen.
Never tested either.
And you put the car on pole. Amazing story.
But that tells you...
What does that tell? Tells me that Mario Andretti was quite a handy racing driver.
Well,
it
tells you that how nicely I felt, you know, in this Formula One car. And quite honestly, you know, I think some of the tricks that I learned even testing tires, that's thanks to Firestone. In those days, I used to do a lot of testing. And we were still running... groove tires, and everybody was going in with groove tires and putting new tires on, and I was wearing mine down to get closer to a slick, and that was working for me, and because I put it on pole right at the end, and you know, just to be quicker than Jackie Stewart was pretty damn good, you know, at the time. So, and quicker than my two teammates, you know, Graham Hill included, you know. So the bottom line is it's all about learning a little bit, you know, of the dynamics of what a racing car really wants. And I did so much testing, you know, for Firestone that it helped me greatly, you know, to just develop some knowledge, you know, of how to get the best out of the tires and so forth.
How did F1's big guns react to you? So first race you try and do, they stopped you driving altogether. Then, or not the drivers, but the, you know, then you go to the Glen and you put it on pole. What were the Jackie Stewarts of this world thinking, do you think, at that time?
You know, I found camaraderie no matter where, because, you know, I had friendships with Jackie. He had been at Indy before, and we had talked about a lot of things, you know, over time. To me, I felt that I was accepted quite well. I think so. And even when I went to stock cars, everybody said, oh, man, you're there. I felt, you know, you could feel like I was a real foreigner, you know, especially in those days. But I never felt out of place. You know, I figure it's a racing world. We're all a big family. I have no complaints, you know, in that respect. I really don't. I didn't have to, you know, I'll drive. I said, hopefully I'll earn some respect from them and give it back and go on, you know.
Let's talk Ferrari. When did Enzo first approach you?
Enzo approached me actually to give me a full drive was after I won not just South Africa, but after I won the Equestria Grand Prix, which in California was a non-championship race where, you know, actually, as fate would have it, in South Africa, Jackie Stewart finished second as well, you know, to me. And then they finished second, both 100 milers, you know, at Equestria. And he offered me, you know, a full drive. And I couldn't take it because of my contract to race here, because Firestone was in a big war with Goodyear, an entire war. And I was, you know, very much involved. And it was, you know, the financial side just did not compare to what Formula One could provide. So, and I was always thinking, you know, the family as well. You know, I had to provide, you know, the best possible, because I've seen, I just lost, you know, that one of my best friends, Billy Foster, and I saw just I left the family, you know, unfortunately young, you know, and I figured I got to provide security for the family in case something happens to me. You know, that was deep down, that's part of, that's also what you feel justifies the risk. You know, you put stuff in your head, you know, that you want to work, you know, and give it, you know, an excuse, you know, why am I taking all this risk? I have beautiful children and everything else. Well, you know, at the same time, you know, I'm satisfying myself, but I got to make sure that I take care of them as well. So that's why I always went for the big buck, you know.
What about Mr. Ferrari, though? Was he an intimidating man?
I can tell you this. Yes, he could be. I first met him in 1969 when I drove 1,000 Ks with Chris Amon in Monza. And Chris was very quick. And so, obviously, I'm trying to be quicker. And somehow, I got into the wall. Just not big, but the body was all askew, you know, and when I came in and I figured, oh my God, he's there, you know, and he's always
Enzo going, was there.
And he was there, and as I pulled in, I said, he's going to fire me, you know. I pulled in, and he had a smile on his face, honest to God. And this is what I learned. This man, he would never fault somebody that actually is trying. That's why he was in love with Jill Villeneuve. I mean, Jill Villeneuve was coming back with the steering wheel in his hands, you know, more than once. And he loved him because his heart, he was out there. And he was a true racer. And I learned, I saw that, oh my God, you know, he's not really all that upset. And then, you know, we talked and he saw that we have many noses and so forth, you know. I said, well, that's what you want. That's who you want on your side, you know. He was a racer through and through. That's all he lived and he breathed, just that. And if he knew that you gave your all, he would never fault you. And that's one thing that I saw. I remember in 82 when I was asked to replace, poor Didier Pironi, you know.
Monza.
Yeah, we did a test in Fiorano. And I had never, you know, I was out of Formula One that whole season already, but I had not driven a turbo Formula One car. So I had to get, you know, used to things. And at the end of the day, when I broke the track record, you know, I see him smile. That was God-given, you know. I says, you know, if I'm pleasing this man, you know, then it's like heaven. You know what I mean? It was just that sort of thing. And so I have had a direct relationship with him. I always dealt with him directly on every deal that I've done, sports cars and Formula One. You know, I never had to deal with Dr. Gozzi, Franklin.
Because you could speak Italian.
Yes.
I suppose that helped. Yeah,
that helped. But I could usually he'd like to deflect, you know. He didn't want to be approached directly. It was like, that's what I always understood. You know, but he and I just dealt directly, which is something that I always value, you know, a great deal.
Yeah, I did one of these podcasts a few months ago with Luca di Montezemolo.
Yeah.
And he said that he was a demanding man, but also a kind man and actually quite a ladies' man as well. Luca said that he used to come back from a Grand Prix and the first question wasn't how was the car, it was, So how are the ladies in Holland or the USA or wherever the rest have been?
Well, that's what, you know, it was funny you mentioned that, because some of the American dealers, Ferrari dealers, they used to bring those, blondes from California and, you know, and waiting in the waiting room. And he would say, you make them wait hours, you know. And he said, which one has the blonde? Bring him in.
Did he pay generously? I remember.
Yes.
2025 marks the 60th anniversary of the first Honda Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix. More than half a century later, the drive and innovation that powers Honda racing still inspires everything Honda does, from F1 victories to the Civic Hybrid being named the 2025 North American Car of the Year. Honda Racing is leading the charge when it comes to innovation. And here's where it gets really cool. Every Honda-powered F1 car is packed with sensors, hundreds of them, all feeding live data straight back to the Honda Racing team in Sakura, Japan. We're talking about real-time analysis that helps engineers squeeze out every ounce of performance on the track. And the amazing part? That same cutting-edge thinking is making its way into the cars we drive every day, thanks to the expertise of Honda Racing engineers. Their work has led to advances like the hybrid technology now used in Honda's consumer vehicles. The 2025 Civic Sedan Hybrid is engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Civic and the latest Honda innovations at honda.com.
Let's talk more about that return in 82. As you say, you were replacing Didier Pironi, who'd had a terrible accident at Hockenheim that year, but was it a no-brainer for you when you got the phone call? Because you were, as you say, you hadn't driven a turbo car. You were, 42 years old at the time. Did you question it at all, or was it, I'm in?
No, I didn't question it. I mean, the thing is, you know, what's interesting is the fact that I was driving for Pat Patrick here, and every one of my contracts says, you know, they you do a contract and you try to obviously get, you know, the maximum that you can, you know, on a contract, on a financial side. And so they own you, you know, like I always did my own contracts, by the way. I had a manager, business manager, you know, for many years. In fact, first one that I had, I managed Jim Clark as well, Chuck Barnes. And but anyway, but I always did my racing contracts myself. And the bottom line is everyone said prohibited vehemently from doing anything else. And so Pat Patrick says, I said, I'm going to do Monza. He says, you can't do that. I says, well, but I will. He says, well, the contract, you know. I says, I'm doing it. Same thing with Colin. You know, when I was driving with Colin, I was driving for Roger Penske here in the States. And so I remember, I don't know if we were Silverstone, you know, we were testing. In between, and there was a free weekend, and they say, you're staying over? I said, no, I have to go back to America. They said, why? I said, I'm racing. They said, you can't do that. I says,
are you talking about 78?
Yeah.
So you're in your there's so many good stories. Your championship season with Lotus, you still did the Indy 500.
I did, every weekend that we had off, I drove for Roger Penske. And I won a couple of races there with it, and I also won the IROC championship that year.
You know, did fatigue not set in at any point?
No.
No.
I mean, no, you prepare yourself. You live that, you know, and I'm not, you're not stupid about it. You know, you just, I was fine. I can tell you a little further about, you know, the test that, and when I went to Fiorano, that morning, you know, when I tested at Fiorano?
In 82.
In 82, just to, not to get ahead of myself. My wife and I, you know, we went over, and I arrived on a Saturday. I arrived in Malpensa in Milan and drove, you know, and we had lunch, you know, at the Cavallino. And then I said, it was time in the afternoon. I said, I'm going to get fitted up in the car. And then I was slated to test the whole day Sunday. That was the plan. And so I get all fitted up in the car, and I said, I'd like to do a few laps in it, you know. And I said, okay. I did 84 laps that day and set a new track record that, you know, before we finished.
This is on the Saturday?
On a Saturday.
And then I landed that morning?
Yeah. landed that morning. And I gave the mechanics a day off. I said, Sunday, take. And I called the Filippi who owned the Moto Guzzi. And I asked for a Le Mans 1200. And Sunday, Deanne and I just went up in the Abitone and he just biking, you know, with a motorcycle. And they had it announced that I was going to be testing all day in Monza. So there are some people there with, you know, getting all ready to umbrellas and start watch the race. And I was going bye. Nobody there.
But, well, about that race, Mario, it was such a magical weekend, wasn't it? You put the car on pole position at your beloved Monza, the place where you'd seen Ascari back in the 50s. Just qualifying in particular, the race wasn't quite so good, but qualifying, just talk us through that day and the emotions of doing it at Monza.
Well, you know, all of it. I mean, it plays. It's just that, you know, the car was right, no question. And I think when it's in a sweet spot, I can really find some little bits, you know, that can make a difference. And if I used to, it's something that even Colin used to question me, you know, a lot of time. I used to play with what they call, you know, the Ackerman, which is means, you know, I used to change like the difference in the tie rods of the steering, to just give one wheel, depending on which corners that I really wanted to have, you know, some specific, like turning in. And small, minute changes used to make a difference. And
particularly through the chicanes at Monza.
Yeah, like, you know, Lesmo, for instance.
Yeah, oh, in the Lesmo, okay.
I needed to do Lesmo, you know, really. And that's where I gained so much time. And so I always pick a corner that I knew that would really pay me back. And Colin said, why do you do that adjustment? I says, I don't even know why. I said, I just do it because I know it works. And so that even the Ferrari mechanics, you know, they were questioning me, you know, so what did the toes, reset the toes? Because I would
and they hadn't done that on that car all season. You were the first one
that was doing that. That was my tweak. And the toes is what you do. The toes remain the same, but I would shorten one side and lengthen the other side, so the toe remains the same. They couldn't understand that. And so things like that were small things that somehow just
came. Where did you learn that? Was it on the dirt tracks of America, or was it just...
You know, testing and all that. Yeah. I used to do some of those small adjustments. Because you had the luxury, you know, doing so much driving. And sometimes, you know, you figure, what if, you know? And so you try those things and then you keep it to yourself, you know? And I didn't share that sort of thing because it was even hard to explain, you know? So some of these things really worked for me, you know?
And so, Mario, the Tifosi went nuts, didn't they?
Yeah, it was actually quite, you know, interesting because, you know, for all the things you said, you know, as far as... you know, Italy and Monza and Ferrari. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that. And things were well, you know. I should have won that race. We lost a turbo with a couple laps to go on the left side. And so, you know, I finished third, but I should have won that race.
Was there ever an option to do a full season with them in 83?
No.
So did you kind of know that it was a bit of a swung song?
I sort of knew that. And the thing that I loved best was the fact that also, as much as Lotus meant to me, it was also good to say, okay, my last Formula One race is with Ferrari. That there was something to that as well, you know. So I said, you know, how fortunate am I?
What about sort of, How Italian are you these days, or were you back then? Because, of course, dual citizenship, American and Italian. When you're racing at Monza, you're very much Italian. I mean, just how do you feel?
I am so always will ever be thankful and, you know, for what has happened to me. America has given me the home, has given me everything. But I always said, even to the Italians, is don't forget, a passport does not change your blood. So there's a lot of pride of me. I saw what my dad, you know, how much he felt, you know, about being a patriot. And he gave up everything. He didn't have to. I mean, no, even though the state, you know, when it's hardline communism, the state owns everything. But he owned 800 hectares of land. He had seven tenants, you know, different parcels. And he was well off in that area and gave it all up, you know, to maintain the Italian citizenship. You know, so that taught me something, you know, the how important it is to have that as a principle. And again, that never leaves you, you know. But never lose the fact that, you know, what gave me the ultimate life, you know, was America. You know, so I'm grateful to both. And in 1977, you know, a lot of people never paid attention. I started, you know, I only realized it only about 2 years ago. In 1977, I won the USGP, and also I won Monza. So I won my home Grand Prix, and I won my native Grand Prix that year. Now, how sweet is that? You know, how important it is for a driver in Formula One to win their home Grand Prix, but also the native. I said, man, you know, Colin, thank you very much. You know, you gave me both, you know, and when I count my blessings, that's what I think about.
Let's talk more about Colin Chapman. Why did it work so well between the two of you?
I love the man, you know, because of his passion too. And he had to be in the swing, you know, where he was really interested. And somehow, I think we fed off one another as far as, you know, just energy, you know, to just get it done. He just loved winning, and that's who you want to be with. You know that, I mean, historically, how much he'd sacrifice anything to give the driver, you know, every advantage possible, weight, safety, anything, just so, you know, you could win. And so I was fortunate to be, you know, you look at his career was peaks and valleys. But when you're with him, you know, during the peaks, you're going to be world champion. And the timing just worked out fantastic. Here's a negative. I'm with, you know, the American team, you know, with the Wells Parnelli Jones.
Yeah.
They decide to pull the rug from under us right at the beginning of the 76 season. And they said, well, they said, you know, without even discussing it with me. And I was the one that put the whole deal together with Firestone. You know, that's who was really financing it. And so at Long Beach, I'm on the grid, and Chris Economak comes in. Mario says, how do you feel about Val just told me that this is the last Formula One race for you? I said, what?
And you're in the car.
On the grid about a couple minutes before the go. And holy man, I was.
Were you, how surprised were you? I mean, when you had time to reflect on it later.
Oh my goodness. I mean, I was so upset. I was so upset. And the next morning, you got to hear that story because that's how Colin and I got together. I think Colin had the worst race of his career. This is the time when Colin was, he's very ambitious, and he had the boat company started, car company. He had so many things going, and the racing was just, you know, not in his mind. You know, that was, he was kind of going through a transition. And the next morning, we're both staying at the Queensway Hilton, they call it, right next to the Queen Mary, actually. And I just went to have breakfast. I was by myself. And
how were you feeling that morning? Because you just driven your last race.
It was one of the lowest lows. And I had my chin in my socks for sure. And so I'm looking, and there's Colin having breakfast by himself. So I joined, and we started commiserating with one another. And I said, Colin, I said, I'm out of a drive, you know. He says, man, he says, I wish I had a decent car to give you. I said, can you give me a car? He says, are you sure? I says, yes. I said, I want to be in Formula One. I committed to be in Formula One for whatever time now to get the job done. I said, and I'm not ready. I said, I told him about the surprise that was handed to me, and he said, you got it. I said, one thing we have to do. I want to be number one on the team, because I knew that there were no two best of anything. I knew that. Even when I was driving in this number third car, I had all junk engines and everything else, spare parts, because Maurice Philippe used to tell me. That's why my first race, the clutch just, you know, started slipping immediately and stuff like that. So I said, Colin, number one. He says, you're in. I said, he said, I'm embarrassed with the car that I have. I said, we'll make it better. We'll just make it better. And we worked on it. In fact, you know, we were getting better. We got a couple of podiums. And then, you know, we won that very last race, as you saw.
The field at Fuji. Yeah.
Well, not only that, but we were quickest on the dry. So it was not just the wet. We were on pole in the dry. So, you know, we were getting there, you know. But he says, I don't know what we have in store. He says, but next year's car is going to make this one look like a London bus. I'll never forget that.
Colin said that.
Typical. You know, so we were.
So that's how it all started, over breakfast.
Yes.
In Long Beach.
Long Beach.
And do you feel that because you went through, you showed so much trust in him, that is kind of, so the relationship got off to a good start, the trust was there, and he built upwards from there.
Absolutely. We were in it, you know, together. And this is one thing that, it was, you know, we discussed about, I said, Colin, you have to come back racing. 100%. I said, you have to delegate. I said, responsibilities for your boat company, the car company. I said, we got to race. And he did. And he did. And so that was a big thing.
So, I mean, let's talk 77. First and only American to win the US Grand Prix. Big moment. We've already kind of discussed that. But then, what was it like to drive a Skirts car for the first time?
Well, you know, that
Skirts being ground effect for people.
Well, you know, it's a long story about how we arrived. The car was not really designed, you know, to be really ground effects at the beginning. When we were discussing about the next, that we were in Hethel, and we were talking about, you know, what everybody is out there, you know, giving input, giving ideas, what we should be doing for next year. And they look at the driver, and I said, you know, from a driver's standpoint, what do I want? I want downforce, I said, without drag penalty. And the one thing, I gave him an example that when I drove the March back in 1970, I think it was, and we were testing in South Africa. The March had like a wing-shaped pods on the side, which were just strictly aerodynamic. And so I was there driving for Granatelli. It was, you know, just a small team. And so we were testing different things. But because of normally aspirated engine, high altitude, you know, the power was down. So I was trying to strip as much drag out of the car as I thought that I could without really having had any data, you know, wind tunnel or anything else. And and I knew that Robin Hurd was pretty sharp, you know, aerodynamicist. And so anyway, I said, let's take those things off the side. So we unbolted them off. And I went out there, and all of a sudden I'm really flying the front end. So I had to use a lot more front wing, you know, which all of a sudden I figured, you know, those are providing downforce. And that's when I said to Colin, I told him about that. And they said, and that's when he built the whole body. It was all a wing shape. And then he said, you know, you build a wing shape and then you put a fence so you can direct the air. So we were testing in Hockenheim. And at the end of the main straightaway, there was I don't know if they called it Bosch curve, but there was, the Bosch curve, I don't know, I think it's in Austria.
Yeah, Boschkopf is Austria.
Yeah, but there was the right-hander that connected the two straightaway. You know, it was a long radius right-hander. And going through like the middle of the right-hander, the car felt like it was really sucking down, which I was closing the gap. We didn't have Skirts at the time. And so I'm saying, Colin, I'm telling you, right in the middle, I'm picking up a lot of downforce. And so he sent Bob Dance to town to buy some plastic strips. So we put plastic strips on there, and I went out there, set a track record immediately. And I said, we have something. I said, but those strips, they're going to last two laps, one lap, two laps, or whatever. And so, and that's when we ran several races with just a brush. Do you ever see that?
Oh, I've seen pictures of it.
The brushes, yeah.
Yeah.
And then, and they could see, and he had, what was it, Phillips, what was the photographer? Famous photographer. He had him photographing the car, different areas to see just how the, you know, where the airflow was and all that. And then Colin realized that we need to close that gap. And that's when he came up with the moving skirts. And that's how this thing was like a sequence, you know, just learning things. And then you figure, well, now we need to really clean up the exit of the diffusers because of the airflow. The more airflow you get, the more downforce. And so, like I said, it was a process, but we were learning as we went.
But Mary, it grew organically, didn't it? It started in a hardware store in Hockenheim when you went and bought some plastic curtain rails or whatever it was, and evolved from there.
But then he started. Then he went wind tunnel more, and then he realized that he needed a moving road because we're directing the air underneath the car. And then we started realizing how much of disruption that the wheels turning. So he's the first one that came up with a moving road tunnel. And so there were so many things happening there. Just
how exciting.
Yeah.
Did you find that exciting? And
oh, I love that. I love the development like that. I mean, as a driver, I mean, what do you want to do? Drive fast, faster and faster through the corners. You want, you know, to be able to do that. And it got to the point that, you know, back in like in, I'd say 80, 81, I mean, there was so much downforce. The cars were like, I mean, glued. And then they had to restrict it, you know, because it was too much. I mean, they, like the Ferrari that I drove, the front wings were actually lifting the car, not putting it down to balance it. You know that? That was the Formula One cars of those years. There was so much front, you know, COP toward the front that they had to use the front wings to raise the front, not to, to balance it.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's R-A-K-U-T-E-N, Rakuten.com.
2025 marks the 60th anniversary of the first Honda Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix. More than half a century later, the drive and innovation that powers Honda racing still inspires everything Honda does, from F1 victories to the Civic Hybrid being named the 2025 North American Car of the Year. Honda Racing is leading the charge when it comes to innovation. And here's where it gets really cool. Every Honda-powered F1 car is packed with sensors, hundreds of them, all feeding live data straight back to the Honda Racing team in Sakura, Japan. We're talking about real-time analysis that helps engineers squeeze out every ounce of performance on the track. And the amazing part? That same cutting-edge thinking is making its way into the cars we drive every day, thanks to the expertise of Honda Racing engineers. Their work has led to advances like the hybrid technology now used in Honda's consumer vehicles. The 2025 Civic Sedan Hybrid is engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Civic and the latest Honda innovations at Honda.com. 1978. Did you know the first time you drove the 79 that that was the car?
I just loved how clean it was. And then the same thing that what we're talking about, you know, the 77, Lotus 77 had, Lotus 78, I should say, had inboard rear brakes. And there was, they were very much in the way of the airflow from the diffusers. And the 79, we still had inboard brakes, but he really sucked them in. He made into the gearbox, which actually turned out to be a big disadvantage to us later on, because he had Hewlin mold as part of the gearbox, half of the brake calipers. So half of the brake calipers was magnesium. And, you know, instead of aluminum, and magnesium has a tendency to obviously flex. And so later on, that's another story. But the bottom line, though, however, as far as the flow, I remember we were in Belgium. And I know the year before, I had a really good time, you know, I had a good time qualifying and so forth. And then it crashed, and, you know, at the start of the race. But I know the Lotus 78 was actually still a good car. But I know that Ronnie had tested the 79 at Understorp.
Your teammate, Ronnie Peterson.
Yes. And I asked him, I said, how did the car feel? He says, like this. Okay, that's all I need to know. So
yeah.
So I told Colin, I said, Colin, I'd like to race that test car. And he said, no. He says, it's not ready. No, this and that. I said, Colin, I'm going to ask the mechanics if they can get a race ready. Well, you do that. So I did it. The boy says, you want to race it? It will be race ready. And we raced it, and we won. But that's when we learned, you know, I had pretty good lead, luckily, because I had to keep pumping the brakes. And this is something we had the whole season. And every time we would tell Colin, and because we were boiling the fluid, especially on full load at the beginning. And then you come in after the race, car cools down a little bit, you pump the brakes, you got brakes. What the hell are you guys talking about?
So the pedal just gets longer and longer the more you run the car.
Yes.
Yeah. God, I thought the car was perfect.
No, yeah. We had some issues.
Yeah.
Some issues.
Do you think the sort of skirts era was particularly good for you in the way you like to drive a car?
Yes, it was. Yeah, indeed. Obviously. I felt the car was really responding, you know, to the way I like. And I had my arms around it. I had a really good feel for things. The unfortunate thing is that as we developed, got more and more downforce, the car just like, why did I abandon Lotus 80, the 80? I loved the car, but only for a few laps. The car was just had so much more downforce. But the skin of the car, the tub, was basically the same as it was a Lotus 79. It was, to me, I looked at it, it was like a beautiful lady, well-dressed, but with cancer, body with cancer, because I know we were testing Paul Ricard, I think, and we were quick. I would be quick for like a few laps, and then the car just started acting weird. And then because I needed to go stiffer and stiffer in springs, then the spring purchase, you know, we're starting to, you know, to pop rivets, you know, and so on and so forth. And you would strengthen that. And then we were getting some actual, where the driver compartment is, you know, it was like a horseshoe like this. We needed to have wrap it around, you know, to have given more torsional stiffness. And he wouldn't have it. He wouldn't have of it because of weight and so on and so forth.
I was gonna say, it was that extra weight, yeah.
Yeah. And one thing that Colin never accepted, it was any suggestion on the technical side from a driver, you know, to do something to the car. He used to go ballistic about that. Sometimes if I would suggest, why don't we do this and that? And he said, you drive, but, you know. I mean,
so how would a debrief go after a session? If you said,
he was fine about
setup. About setup, okay.
So setup
it's a design thing, right?
Design thing. He just didn't want to. And That's the only time where he and I disagreed, you know, because I was watching, you know, the following year, like the Williams, they built the right car. A lot of things, you know, they took what Colin had and they perfected it. And Colin was already thinking about his next design. He was already bored with that. But the next design actually would turn out to be illegal, which we all knew. You know, but the beauty about Colin is he always is looking, he's looking at the rules. And he's like a crackerjack lawyer. You know, you read the law. I mean, you got to press that envelope. You know, and that's what makes you a winner in court. And that's, he is an engineer. That's, he was reading the rules and getting everything out of the rules, you know, right to the limit, leave nothing on the table. This time he stepped a little bit further because he was working with talking with unsprung weight, trying to actually try to put downforce on the unsprung weight directly, which in a clever way, but, you know, it was illegal, you know, and it never turned out to be. But the thing about Colin, as you can see, he was such a maverick, always thinking ahead. He was genius. And geniuses get bored very easily, you know, with the status quo. And that's the way I read Colin, you know. He wanted to win, but you know what? Okay, we got this now. We go to the next step. Now we really get something, you know.
What did your success in 78 mean to Colin, do you think?
What I loved about Colin, again, you know, he would express his emotions. I mean, just the classic throwing
the cap as you cross the line, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, things like that. Colin loved to win. And as a driver, I love to see that. You know, he crossed the line. I said, man, he was truly, truly happy. A winner, period. You know, and as a driver, there's so much encouragement, you know, when you see that. You know, you do it for yourself, but, you know, when even the mechanics, when they express themselves with the poor mechanics, they work so hard. And that's the thing, you know, that's what you strive for and to win. And when they express themselves, you know, that's the greatest thing for a driver. For me, it was a sim, you know, I make myself happy, but I make them happy as well.
What was it like to ride the crest of that wave in 78?
Oh,
you've got a brilliant car. The vibe in the team is great between you and Ronnie and Colin.
Couldn't be any better. You know, it just, it was...
Was it your most enjoyable? I mean, obviously the results of that.
No, it was.
Was it the best
it was
period?
Incredibly enjoyable. Yeah, incredibly. It's what you dream about. It's, you know, you pinch yourself, you know, am I really living this? You know, so, yeah, all of that. And, you know, I just look back with such fondness, you know, everything that was going on, all the good, everything that Colin, what he gave me, you know, was something that was beyond precious, you know. And I never took it for granted.
Monza, that's where you win the title. How tough was it to lose your teammate that weekend?
It's hard to explain those things, you know. It was such a waste because he should not have died. He should not have died of those injuries. I did go over there when the accident happened. I ran over there and Colin said, don't go. And I think, you know, he would have been, his legs were really in bad condition, but I kept saying, I said, okay, he's going to be limping for a while, but he's going to live.
Was he conscious at that point?
No, I think he was somewhat delirious, you know. He was in shock, for sure, because, you know, I tried to talk to him and so forth. He was in shock. I mean, it's understandable. But he was not that his head it was compromised or anything. I don't think they had any of those injuries. There was some fire. There was, you know, he had some burns. But basically, by any standard, you know, he should have never died. Not from an embolism, because when you have that type of injuries, immediately, I mean, you just dissolve, you get blood thinners and so on and so forth. You never got any of that. And that's, I will fault that forever. And that's when we hear again, you know, we're pushing, you know, for our own doctors. We have to have our own doctors to direct the locals to do what we need to do under these circumstances. And we achieved that.
How difficult was it to get back in the car, having seen Ronnie?
Well, you know, it's, that was, you know, I hate to say it, you know, because it sounds so callous, you know, but that was never the issue for me. That was my job. And it was never, why do I do this or should I? Because I had seen too much of it before. But you never get used to it, believe me. It's not that you get used to it, but things are never the same. You know, you lose a friend, you lose a, and he was not the first friend that I had lost. And I couldn't celebrate, for sure. I said this many times, this had to be, should have been the happiest day of my career, for sure. And I couldn't celebrate. And I don't think we ever really did to the in earnest. The celebration is the rest of your lifetime. You know, you know it's there with you. But Deanne and I, we just, how, you know, because we were close to the family, with Barbara and the kids, you know, we used to spend time, our kids, you know, so there was, it was more than just, we were teammates. Used to come, when he came to America, like he raced at the Glen, we come to the lake ourselves, we go crazy doing stuff, you know, as usual. And we used to recreate, you know, in so many ways and be competitive, raise hell and have fun, you know. So it was, you know, we lost a true friend there, you know. And again, you know, it was just another one of those sad situations.
How quick was Ronnie?
It was quick. Ronnie was quick. He was quick, and I think what I had over him, I think I had I had the technical. I understood the technical side a little better, and that's what I felt that I had over him.
Do you think he learned off you?
I don't know. I don't know how to say that, but. A lot of time, I think he got my setups and so forth, and a lot of things because I had pretty good understanding, you know, of the cars. Cars were very sincere, were very good, responded well. And, I mean, he had his own way of doing things too, but used to wind up with a lot of the time with my setups and so forth because then, and he could drive over things, you know, just. He had fantastic car control and all that sort of thing.
All these pictures I see of him woodcut at Silverstone sideways, flat out.
Yeah. Fun driver, you know. We just, I loved the man. I really did.
Mario, who was the best F1 driver you raced against, do you think?
It's hard to say. I think very calculated was Nicky, you know, in his own way. I think James really had a lot of talent, raw talent. Himself, you know, I raced enough with Jackie Stewart. There were moments, you know, where they, over the decades, there was always somebody, you know, that was really up here. And that's what keeps you motivated. That's what, those are the ones that make you a better driver because you know that you got work to do. And there's always someone that's better than you.
Schechter
was is another one, you know, pure car control with him, hot and cold in some ways, you know. He's not the one that you had to deal with race in or race out, but good, you know. But on any given day, you know, hard to beat.
Mansell.
Very good.
Because, of course, you raced him in Formula One, but you also raced him, you were his teammate in IndyCar, Nigel.
Nigel had pure talent, yeah, for sure.
Now look, Mario, yours was an amazing career. When were you at your peak?
It's hard to say, really. I think probably in my 30s, for sure. You know, in those days, as you could see, you were not legal, really, to race until today. Look at Verstappen, you know. He's already a veteran at, what, 22?
He's still 21, actually.
Still 21, right? He's already a veteran. And in those days, you could not even...
You could only get your license, you were saying.
Yeah, but even Formula One, had you ever seen in those years, you know, anyone, you know, in early 20s? No. And so I felt I was still wet behind my ears when I was in mid 20s, you know, like when I won the championship here in IndyCars, I was 25, and I was the youngest man to, the youngest champion to do it at that point. You know, nowadays, you know, it's a little different, you know, but I felt that, I truly felt that in my mid-30s, I was probably my peak.
Okay, so we're sort of mid-70s there. Does age make you slower?
Has to. I mean, you don't like to admit it, you know, and I wish there was a signal there somewhere to tell you. Sometimes you get burned out, whatever works. Sometimes there's something that obviously has to decrease. What kept me motivated also was my son, Michael, you know, and being my teammate. Michael was brutally quick, and he really was. And I tell you, he got screwed over, and you know, with McLaren, you know. But if he would have listened to me and just toughed it out, he would have been world champion. He was quicker than Mika Hakkinen.
Why didn't it work out for him at McLaren in 1993? He had a pretty nifty teammate. Didn't help, probably.
No, it helped. There was no big deal, actually.
With Senna.
When you look, yeah. Mm. You know, he was, you know, those days, you know, there was this Joe Ramirez. There was something, he had something against Michael. I could tell you some stories, you know, that I actually don't want to say publicly, you know, as to how he was getting screwed big time. But here's what happened. The worst thing that happened is Michael joined that team, and he got top dollar from Ron Dennis because Ayrton was going Williams, and Michael was going to be number one. And Ron Dennis got Mika Hakkinen from Lotus from nothing, basically. And all of a sudden, he had three drivers, but two high-paid drivers. One had to go. And they did everything they could, you know, to make it uncomfortable for Michael, because there was Mika Hakkinen sitting there doing nothing. And then when there was a test, they would use him and they wouldn't even use Michael. In those days, the tests were restricted. And also remember, if you look at the rules, in those days, practice, there was a limited amount of laps, 23 laps, the most you could do counting in and out. And you could not test. Look back at the regulation.
It was a really bad time to come in.
It was the worst time. Mm-hmm. He went there at the worst time possible from a rule standpoint. He went with the best team at the worst time because they lost the Honda power besides. Quite honestly, this thing with Mika being there for free and then him, you know, Ron having to pay and then Michael's wife be so demanding, you know, on the other side, there's a lot of things that, you know, were working against Michael tremendously. The only thing that Michael could have done, if he would have had my character, he would have gone to Ron and says, you know, at the end of the year, because Ron said, I'm going to run Mika, you know, for the last three, four races, I think.
After Monza, yeah.
And actually, he wanted to run it from Monza on. I begged him to have let Michael run Monza, you know, because I, for the obvious reasons. And then that's when Michael had a podium there, for, you know. And, you know, Ayrton is not with us, but Ayrton had respect for Michael because after the race in Manicourt, they tested the Monday and Tuesday, and they were both like within a tenth of one another. When Michael finally got his arms around what was going on, and he had a, you know, the Series 7 and Ayrton had a Series 8 engine. And so a lot of factors here. If Michael, here's what Michael needed to do. Sit down with Ron and said, yeah, because Senna left right after that. And I said, Ron, I want to stay. I want to win the world championship with you. If he would have just said that, but he let his freaking manager, you know, who was a nice guy, you know, talk for him. And that was Michael's fault, you know, in that respect. He got screwed the first year, but he could have toughed it out.
So you think there would have been the option to stay for 94?
Yeah.
If he tried a little bit more,
Here's Ron. All of Ron said to Michael, he says, I cannot promise you that I will renew you. I will pick up the option until November. That's what he said. And Michael felt, well, I'm not going to have a sabbatical, so, you know, if I'm out of here. Instead of sitting down and say, you know what, I'll wait it out. I committed to Formula One. I want to stay in Formula One. And I think Ron would have, it would have worked out. It would have worked out, clearly. And so I fought Michael for that. And we talked about
it. Do you think he regrets it now?
Oh, I think he does.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, look, what of all your achievements in your career, what is it? You've won 109 major races, I think it is, in your career. 111? Maths isn't my strong point, Marriott. But of those races and of all that success, where do your F1 achievements stack up?
Well, obviously, I think I should have devoted more time to Formula One, perhaps. I have no regrets, you know, because I made my own bed and sleep in it and everything else. But that was my ultimate dream, quite honestly. You know, that's what got me interested in the sport to begin with. You know, so doing some of the things, like we said, you know, just winning here and then, you know, and then winning Italy the same, all those things have tremendous meaning to me. Not anyone else, but I know what it did for me and the satisfaction that I derive from it. Formula One is still an absolute love for me, no question, will always be. Again, it's all I can say that I'm thankful that I gave myself the opportunity, you know, to devote 100% of the time, you know, to Formula One for a period of my career. And thank you, Colin, for giving me what I needed. And again, you know, my career would in any way be anywhere the satisfaction that I'm enjoying today without Formula One.
You say you wish you'd committed more time. Do you mean just commit full time earlier than you did?
Earlier, yes. I could have, you know, if I would have joined Formula One, say, in 1971. Unfortunately, 72, 73 was not very good years for Ferrari. Might not have been just as good, but at the same time, I was offered, you know. And because I drove the 72 car, it was not good.
That kind of helped make your mind up.
Yeah. Actually, I was glad that I didn't do it because I drove it to South Africa. I said, man, this car is not good. It was very flexible and all that. And but nevertheless, I think, again, things played out. Ultimately, anyway, and looking back, I have no regrets, really. At the same time, things happen for a reason, and I got more than I deserve out of the sport. That's something I know.
Any guys you wish you'd driven for in Formula One who you didn't? Maybe Bernie Ecclestone, or... I mean, you did a little bit for Frank, but not very much.
Oh, yes. Well, I would have... The mistake that I made when I came away from Lotus, I had a choice. I had the clear choice to go with McLaren or Alfa Romeo. Yes.
What made you go Alfa Romeo? The Italian.
I felt the year before at Watkins Glen, Giacomelli led the race. He had an issue at the end. I figured it's Alfa's time. And somehow... This is one time I went with my heart instead of my brains. And that one I will regret. Try not to dwell on that regret, but that one I will regret.
Well, my final... I've so enjoyed this chat, Mario. It's been wonderful. But are there any more Andretti's to carry on the speed legacy? Do you think Marco, for example, has he got Formula One ambitions? Do you think he can do it?
I think it's too late for him. You know, it's... I think he his opportunity... Might have been even when he tested for Honda in Jerez. I felt that he could have cultivated that one a little bit. And it was certainly on the Honda side, there was no interest. And quite honestly, I can't make any excuses. You know, it had to be him to express himself. You know, nobody had to push me to do anything. So, and in all fairness, quite honestly, I must say that, you know, I was brought up in a totally different environment. I was brought up in a situation where you can't have it, and I wanted it. And he was brought up in a situation, you can have it if you want it. There's a big difference in that. So it's hard to know where the real desire is. And I think Marco, for one, is very happy. Obviously, I don't think he wants to do anything else. Only he knows how much he really loves to drive.
Well, you certainly did. Mario, thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Well, there you have it. The living legend that is Mario Andretti. As cool as ever. And I don't know about you, but I could have listened to that fabulous Andretti accent all day. I took so much from our chat, but perhaps the biggest take-home message was his passion. He still loves racing in all of its forms, and the fire that made him such a formidable competitor is still there, burning as bright as ever. His emotion when talking about former teammate Ronnie Peterson was tangible, and his memory of events from more than 40 years ago was impressively sharp. And there are clearly a few things that still rankle him, not least his son Michael's season with McLaren back in 1993. Thanks for your time, Mario. I absolutely loved our chat. Well, that's about it for this week's very special episode, but there's just enough time to share a bit of feedback about last week's show with Takuma Sato. He was so articulate and, like Mario, so passionate about our sport. Taku was my hero, said Shoya on Twitter. Suzuka 2002 was my first ever live Formula One experience, and to this day, I still remember everyone in the grandstand cheering when our hero drove past us. That moment still gives me goosebumps. Well, I was there too, Shoya, and it sticks in the memory as one of the great emotional moments in Japanese Grand Prix history. Thanks for the feedback, and please keep it coming because we love it. Remember to use the hashtag F1BeyondTheGrid, and you can tweet me at TomClarksonF1. And if you enjoyed the episode with Mario, why not leave us a rating and review on your favourite podcast app? It really helps others to find and enjoy the show, and that's all we want to do, share our passion for this wonderful sport. Beyond the Grid is produced by F1 in association with Audioboom. Until next time, keep it flat out.
...2025 marks the 60th anniversary of the first Honda Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix. More than half a century later, the drive and innovation that powers Honda Racing still inspires everything Honda does, from F1 victories to the Civic Hybrid being named the 2025 North American Car of the Year. Honda Racing is leading the charge when it comes to innovation. And here's where it gets really cool. Every Honda-powered F1 car is packed with sensors, hundreds of them, all feeding live data straight back to the Honda Racing team in Sakura, Japan. We're talking about real-time analysis that helps engineers squeeze out every ounce of performance on the track. And the amazing part? That same cutting-edge thinking is making its way into the cars we drive every day, thanks to the expertise of Honda Racing engineers. Their work has led to advances like the hybrid technology now used in Honda's consumer vehicles. The 2025 Civic Sedan Hybrid is engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Civic and the latest Honda innovations at honda.com.